afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your case is the only case set for oral submission today. Everything else is submitted on briefs. Your panel this afternoon is to my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. I'm Leanne Dofino. Understand both sides are ready, so if you call the case, we'll get started. Brent, you ready?
May it please the court. I would like to start off with what I consider to be my most difficult issue, and that is jury misconduct. There's no question, I think, that we have here that the jury in this case was instructed not to use quotient verdicts. The jury was told that if you use a quotient verdict, that under the law is jury misconduct. We have evidence in the form of affidavits that the jury did just that. And the question is whether or not, under our rules that govern the trial of case, we will allow that to come to light. That is, we will allow the disobedience of specific instructions given by the trial judge to be brought to light. Now, obviously, there's a conflict, at least between the rules. 606B of the Rules of Evidence, 327B of the Rules of Civil Procedure, talk about jury deliberations and the fact you're not supposed to be able to have testimony about those. We contrast those with Rule 226A. Where the court gives specific instructions to the jury saying, one, there are specific rules you have to follow. If you don't follow these rules, it's misconduct. If it's misconduct, it may require a new trial, and you may be called to testify in the event there are allegations of jury misconduct. Now, one of the first issues I think that we have raised is whether or not, if you use a quotient verdict, is it deliberations? Clearly, it occurs during the deliberative process. But the question is it deliberations as defined by the Texas Supreme Court and the Golden Eagle Archery case? And what the court there said, and there it was the question of contact between jurors outside the jury room, you know, was that deliberations? But the court defined what was deliberations. And the court said that deliberations is the weighing of the evidence. We know from prior cases that where a quotient verdict is used, it is basically, the courts have said, it is a substitute, basically, of a formula for deliberations. It is chance. The Jenkins court out of Amarillo said it's nothing more than a verdict by chance. And they said in the Landreth case out of Texarkana that it's nothing more than substitution of arbitrarily selected figures for deliberations. So we have courts saying that you're substituting arbitrarily selected figures for deliberations. And the Corpus Court in Sunset Brick says it's the substitution or product of absence of thought and reflection by the jury.
And you don't think that's the same as trading answers?
I think it's a little bit different from trading answers, and I know you're going to the Damien case out of this court. But trading answers, I assume there's a little horse trading that goes on in all jury deliberations. Me trying to convince you, you trying to convince me, and that is deliberation, where I'm trying to sway you over to my side, or you're trying to sway me over to your side. Here, though, there's just an agreement. We're going to put in these numbers. Somebody, the foreman in this case, presiding juror, was going to...
Showing your age there.
Judge, if you only knew, today's my 60th birthday, so it's
well, happy
hard,
birthday.
Hard on many, many fronts to finally have to admit that. So, but yes, presiding juror, got them, added them up, divided them, and that is not deliberations. Now, the other issue is, you know, we believe there is a conflict between 226A and 606B and 327B. We know that the recent amendments to 226A were effective April 1st of 2011. There is a rule of construction under the Code Construction Act which says, you know, in the case of a conflict, the latest enacted statute, rule, regulation will control, because when it's enacted, it's presumed that the legislature, Supreme Court, whomever, was aware of the prior rules when they enacted the latter version. And the latest amendment, I believe, we checked on 327B was like in 1984. And the latest amendment to 606B, I believe, was in 1998. And the, again, current version of 226A was in April of 2011. And clearly, the court was aware of the prior statutes, or not statutes, rules, when it amended 226A. Now, the third impact, we believe, and why courts, trial courts, should be able to go into this, is because basically you're going to render the court's charge meaningless. There is a rule of construction which says the legislature is never presumed to do a meaningless act. So I don't know if I agree with it, but that's a rule of construction that's out there. Same thing, I believe, applies to regulations as well as rules from the Supreme Court. But if you go to the charge of the court, the judge specifically tells the jury, do not use quotient verdicts. If you do a quotient verdict, it is misconduct. If it's misconduct, then we may have to start the whole process over again. You may have to be called as a witness. And then the judge says, if a juror breaks any of these rules, tell that person to stop and report it to me immediately. Well, first off, how will you ever have a mistrial? How will you ever have misconduct during the deliberative process unless the judge is able to be informed of it? And if a juror is incompetent to testify or incompetent to tell the judge about it, this whole process is meaningless. You have words here that don't really make sense.
Well, a juror could send out a note during the course of the deliberation saying there are people in here who are violating your order.
And then you are violating 606B and you're violating 327B because that juror is providing evidence regarding what is happening during the deliberative process.
How is it any different after the fact to do that?
We believe that for the rules to have meaning, that is, for the rules not to be meaningless, you must be able to do it.
It says may. It may
result in a...
And doesn't that mean may in accordance with the other rules that are applicable?
Well, if may means sometimes it can, sometimes it cannot, depending upon whether or not whatever was being done was a true violation. But a quotient verdict, by definition, is misconduct, is jury misconduct. And then how could, if a jury uses a quotient verdict, how could it may result in a mistrial if you can never, ever take testimony regarding what happened during the deliberative process? You're telling the jury something that simply is not true, because it will never, if this rule is enforced, as plaintiffs are arguing that you can never take testimony, then the jury would be able to use quotient verdicts, do whatever they want to, and as long as it's during the deliberative process, even if they're violating the rules of the court, it can never result in a new trial, because you can never adduce evidence regarding what was happening during the deliberative process.
Brett, let me tell you one of the hills you got to climb here, and that is...
I know it's a hill.
...that there's one set of rules for criminal and civil, and on the criminal side, it's not the state who is appealing quotient verdicts. And allowing quotient verdicts is going to be allowing defense to offer evidence of an improper verdict returned by a jury on punishment. And, you know, are the Supreme Court and the Court of Criminal Appeals really going to say it's okay, or it's okay on the civil side but not on the criminal side?
But the question is, Your Honor, is it's part of our law. If it's not a good rule, we ought to throw it out. But if it is part of our law and we have it and we allow it to go on and not do anything about it, what are we doing to our judicial system?
How's it different from trading votes? I will find liability if you guarantee me the damages won't exceed X amount.
The jury is told in the same instructions not to trade answers.
Number 9 is trading votes. Number 10, I believe, is the quotient verdict. The Damien case, there are some distinctions. Again, the argument about the conflict between 226A and 606B and 327B, from looking through the opinion, doesn't seem to have made in that case. There was no argument as to whether or not that was deliberations or not deliberations. The key focus, it seemed to me, in Damien was whether or not it was outside influence versus inside influence, and that was the primary basis for the court's distinction in that case. But the other thing, the Supreme Court in 2009, in a case called In re Columbia, overturned 150 years of law regarding whether or not we're going to be able to discern the basis for a trial court granting a new trial. And this is why you say, well, this isn't a granting of a new trial. You're right. But this is why it's important. For 150 years, it was probably as well established as any principle under Texas law that you couldn't get into that. And the court, in overturning that, rules, common law, said there were three overriding considerations why this court could no longer follow that rule. The first overriding consideration has to do with respect for the judiciary or rule of law. And if you listen to the oral argument in that case, you'll see there were quite a few of the justices who were very concerned about what it appeared. And if you look here, you've got rules that are in black and white that have been adopted, yet we're saying, and we have affidavits that we know that there may have been violated. We had two, maybe three affidavits of jurors saying they were violated, but we're not going to do anything about that. The Supreme Court had the same problem in that, you know, not allowing the parties, the public, to know the basis for the granting of a new trial. The second overriding issue was it detracts from the transparency we strive to achieve in our legal system. And, you know, here, again, you have affidavits filed. You know, at least there is some argument that the jury didn't follow the court's instructions, yet we're not going to do anything about them. We're going to ignore it, and we're going to countenance the jury ignoring the instructions that the court gave them.
Well, not only that, but we're going to tell the jury that we will.
You're telling the jury falsehood. I mean, I thought about this. I said, if I was one of the counsel's defense or plaintiff in this case, and I got, you know, it was closing the argument, I say, well, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, the judge has just instructed you not to do a quotient verdict, that if you do, it's guilty of jury misconduct, you can be called to testify, and it may result in a new trial. That's all a lie. Now, I'd be sanctioned, thrown in court, whatever, but that's sort of the truth, because none of that will happen under these rules. The third thing in the Columbia case is respect for the reasonable expectations of the parties and the public, and that is the parties and the public all have an expectation that the rule of law will be followed. And that if the rule of law isn't followed, then there will be some corrective action that will take place. And if we have a rule of law and it's flagrantly ignored, then the respect for reasonable expectations of the parties and the public will be diminished. And we believe, you know, I know my time is about up, but, and I know, Judge Daffino, as you said, I've got a hill to climb, and I realize that. But I think it's an important issue. I think the whole process is important. One of the things that Judge Justice Johnson, who wrote the majority in In Re Columbia, talked about in the argument was about our respect for a judiciary. What's happening, you know, with the public's perception of the courts, the process, and there was a lot of concern about the public's perception. And that is important as far as the courts and the, you know, obeying the rulings and stuff, that we perceive that there are rules and that those rules are followed. Thank you very much.
I'd like to ask a question.
Yeah. Not so fast there.
And I'm going to ask it of both sides. The rule 226A is part of the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, which are, of course, promulgated by the Supreme Court. And generally, maybe I should correct that, always with the input and advice of the Supreme Court Advisory Committee, which are online and available to be looked at. And I have not looked at them on this these in required instructions to see if they had anything to say about why the required instructions under 226A were changed, whether this conflict was taken into consideration, or what kind of signal the Supreme Court might have been sending with regard to 9 and 10.
If you look at the advisory committee notes, I don't think you're going to find anything about this issue. Primarily, a lot of the changes that took place in April of 2011 mm-hmm. had to do with social media, the fact that jurors now have phones back in the deliberation rooms and, you know, can check it on Google or whatever else. It was to address a lot of technological advances that have taken place. But, you know, these issues were there in the Supreme Court. This language was in a different form, was there before the rule change, and the Supreme Court moved it but decided to keep this language in the rule, knowing of the 606B language as well as the 327B language as well.
Thank you.
Any questions? Okay, David.
May it please the court. I recall being 60. I'm going to address primarily the same issue that the counsel for the appellant has addressed, not without a little bit of regret, because if you love irony, you've got to appreciate Dr. Yagnik's argument on why the court should find that the negligence of the hospital was established as a matter of law. I will address that just briefly by pointing to the City of Keller versus Wilson. As applied to Yagnik's argument, the hospital negligence would have had to been established by proof of negligence that reasonable jurors could not disregard. In this case, there was no conclusive evidence contrary to the verdict, with only one logical inference, and that was that the hospital was negligent. They don't have that. They didn't make that case. Now, I disagree that there's a conflict between the rules, and I'm going to go way out on a limb, but my recollection is that there was no significant change to Rule 226A significant to the issues in this case today, other than, of course, 226A has both the instructions to the panel and the instructions to the jury when they're first seated, and finally the charge. And my recollection is that they actually deleted language regarding you could be called in here as a juror and compelled to testify. I think that was actually taken out in shortly before this case was tried. And since it's a procedural issue, I think that if I'm correct, then the rule as it was written as of the day of the trial is the rule that applies to this case. It's a good rule. jurors should not be compelled to come or allowed to come and talk about their verdict unless outside the exception that's an important one, and that is the outside influence. It's a good rule. It's a constitutional rule that Dr. Yagnik has not, again, urged his constitutional issue. We go all the way back to the McDonald versus Pless case. It's a United States Supreme Court case, 1915, that recognized that you've got to protect the jury verdict from the jury system from being virtually destroyed by the fact that lawyers could rip apart the verdict by getting one juror or another, or perhaps several, to challenge their verdict.
So is it your position that you can never prove that a quotient verdict was arrived at and that's how the jury made their decision?
I think that's what the rule says, Your Honor. I think you've got 12 jurors, and if some of them stand up and go, Judge, we've been talking about this stuff out of court before or at a lunch break or something like that, but I believe once the judge hands the jury the charge, what goes on in deliberation, and by the way, there's a question of how deliberation should be defined, and so that I think I did answer your question. I'm going afar, but I think deliberation begins when the judge hands the jury the charge and tells them it's their case, and the deliberation continues until they arrive at a verdict or the judge takes the charge away from them.
So what's the point of telling them that they can't do it if there's no teeth to that?
Well, I think you're telling people to do the right thing. And the point of it may very well be that you've got 12 jurors in there, and some of them will speak up and go, well, we're not supposed to address that. We're not supposed to do that. We can't do that.
But you also tell them if somebody's violating these instructions, report it to me at once. But to follow to the logical conclusion of what you're saying, they can't do that.
Okay.
Then, and it also tells them you will be guilty of juror misconduct.
Yes, and if I'm incorrect about how the rule now reads, and that language is still in there, and it may be in some places and deleted in others, certainly my recollection that it was deleted from the instruction to the jury once they're seated. But if it's in there, then that's something perhaps they need to clean in the rules later. But that's the rule. And it's been recognized by a lot of courts. It is a copy, roughly, not real roughly. It's pretty close to the federal rule of procedure, and it's been defended by certainly on constitutional grounds by the United States Supreme Court and by the Supreme Court of Texas and by this court, I believe.
David, suppose that instead of an affidavit in the trash can had been found a piece of paper with each juror's name and an amount by that juror's name, a sum at the bottom divided by whatever the number of jurors, and an amount, and that amount was the same amount as on the verdict. Would that piece of paper be admissible?
Your Honor, that's a great question. Yes, I think the piece of paper would be admissible because the bailiff could say, look what I found. But it's okay for the jurors, as long as they don't agree in advance, they can say, where are we approximately? But as long as they aren't bound by the dividend that they arrive at, then it's okay. Now, how are you going to prove that? Because you can't call one of the jurors to confirm what everybody suspects from the piece of paper found in the waste paper basket.
You can't offer evidence to defend a verdict against that piece of paper. You obviously can't cross-examine the piece of paper, so all you have is uncontested evidence of a quotient verdict.
You would have uncontested evidence.
That's uncontestable.
Your Honor, it would be okay for them to do the same arithmetic as long as they didn't agree in advance to be bound by.
How do you know if you can't get the evidence?
You don't know either way. The burden, the presumption would be that the verdict was good, I should think, because you can't prove one way or the other that the jury didn't misbehave, because you can't go beyond the piece of paper to confirm one way or another with testimony of any of the jurors. That's the rule. And you know, we may change the rules down the way. Sometimes that happens. Things get changed later. And sometimes we'll all have cases, I suspect, where we thought, boy, I wish the law had been differently when I'd tried my case. But that's the rules that we have today. I think they're valid. And I think it has a good reason. If you look in the history of the case, you look at the Tanner case cited by Golden Eagle Archery, you look at the old federal case I mentioned a moment ago, you look at Golden Archery. All of these cases recognize that that jurors should be protected and that verdicts should be protected. And perhaps it's more that verdicts should be protected. But if we bring someone in, they may have had a bias against a party. They may have been the sort of juror who wants to continue their 15 minutes of fame by stirring up one side or another. It may be someone who is a solitary juror is incapable of hurting anybody's feelings by telling them no. And there could be any number of reasons why a juror would give you an affidavit. And we all know these affidavits are drawn by attorneys. They all read the same. And they all put in the magic words that you look for. So I think it's a good rule. Does it possibly conflict with some other rules? Maybe. Does that change allow this court to change what the court below did? I don't think so. And I believe that the court should affirm
Can there ever be jury misconduct then?
You can if you can prove that an outside influence, and you can if it was reported by I think you could. What if one of the jurors goes to one of the parties and says, listen, you'd have lost that case if I hadn't done X, Y, Z, and it's a violation of the rules, and they party tells his lawyer, and the lawyer does what the lawyer is obliged to do and tells the court, then it is
How do you show it influenced the verdict, though?
Well, I'm not sure how you do that, but how do you ever show that? Because we've got 10 affidavits in this in this case, if we don't have 11, that's saying it didn't happen. So we want to send it back down and let all 12 jurors come in and testify, and the trial judge tell you what the trial judge's opinion is, whether the trial judge wants to try this case again. I think it's to recognize, to paraphrase Churchill, jury trial may be the worst form of deciding a conflict other than every other means that has been attempted. He talked about democracy, of course, but it's just the best you can. I think it's the best you can do, except that maybe you can rewrite some rules, maybe you can fine tune them. But I don't think that's the purpose of this court today.
I think in England they don't have juries in civil trials.
I don't think they do either, Your Honor. That's why Churchill talked about democracy and not jury trial, Judge, I guess. Finally, I'd like to make one other point, and that is Dr. Yagnik is arguing that he's entitled to a new trial on all of the complaints that he's urged on appeal. I don't think that's right. If you think this one issue we've really talked about today is wrong, then you send it back down to the court and let the judge have his hearing. Call in all 12 jurors, listen to their testimony.
I'm sorry, I wasn't meaning to interrupt you, but I guess I'm about to jump over the bench. What about the possibility of abating and remanding for it, just for this hearing on should we decide that there was some evidence raised by the affidavits of jury misconduct?
If you thought
abate and remand for a hearing.
Your Honor, if you thought that you could do that within the rules and it was the correct thing to do, that would certainly be a judicial economy to abate it and send it back. That would be an easy and obvious way, and I thank you for suggesting it. Also, there are other issues that would, if sustained, might bring about a partial remand. But what we're really urging the court to do is to affirm the judgment of the trial court, send us on our way. If the court has no questions, I'm through. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Brent?
Very quickly. In England, you can get a jury trial on a libel case. I believe that's the only civil case that you can.
I'm sorry?
You can get a jury trial on libel. So I think everything else is determined by the court.
No, I didn't mean a jury trial, remand for a jury trial. I meant remand for here.
England.
Oh, in England.
England,
oh,
we were saying.
Excuse me.
Yeah. You get it for libel.
Okay.
Oscar Wilde. the counsel argued the verdict should be protected, and obviously there is a strong, policy for protecting verdicts, but there's also, I think, equally strong impetus if there's something wrong to correct it, and if somebody's not following the rules to address that. And again, just because you have affidavits, I think counsel has recognized that, doesn't mean that the verdict's going to be thrown out. All it means is the court will examine to see whether or not what is alleged is true or not.
To what extent did the court examine the affidavits?
I'm sorry?
To what extent did the court examine the affidavits?
The court said, I can't consider these. I can't have a hearing. These are inadmissible under 606B and under 327B.
So just
no,
didn't
just
even read them?
The door was closed. There was no scrutiny about, well, are they credible, not credible, anything. That simply was not done. On the verdict form, what happened about being called to testify, that was moved to the front of the instructions given to the jury when they're first brought in. And again, as you know, it says, if during deliberations, if someone violates these, report it immediately to the court. Well, how are you going to report it? How are you going to investigate it without going into the jury deliberations if that is where the misconduct occurred? Let's see what else I had here. Last thing, and I'll give the court some time back. Counsel talked about whether or not it was established as a matter of law under the city of Keller, the negligence of the hospital. And the only thing I'll say that is, city of Keller obviously is the law, but where a jury is to be guided by expert testimony, which in a medical malpractice case, a jury is to be guided by expert testimony, and there is only one expert testimony on a particular issue, the courts have held, the jury's bound to accept that. It's different when we're talking about, you know, me testifying against Ms. Faust just as lay persons or lay witnesses, but where the jury is guided by expert testimony and there is only one witness, one testimony in that point, the jury's required to accept that. I know we're asking a lot for the court. I know we're asking this court really to go where no other court has gone before. But it's not without precedent. The Supreme Court did it on motions for new trial, the basis, the reasons for that, because of policy considerations, and I think those policy considerations apply with equal force in this case, and we would urge the court either to remand the case back so the court could conduct the hearing, or as Justice Gardner said, perhaps abate it and send it back for a hearing on this issue. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you. We appreciate your coming on such an unpleasant day and on your birthday to argue. Obviously, we are very much interested in this subject, so your argument has been very helpful. Your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business, and this court will be adjourned.